Okay, a number of people have emailed me, so I'll just say a few things before we begin. Someone asked about Dr. Feldblum. Here's a copy of his book. It's called Prakim Umechkarim B'Talmud. I picked it up at a used bookstore for about $8. It has a nice English introduction in which it explains his view of the Talmud. This is, as we spoke about last week, he was the big man at YU in terms of critical study of the Talmud, and if the authentic history of Yeshiva University is ever written, he'll play a significant role because his personality or his method of study became a focal point of controversy in the 60s and 70s. In fact, unfortunately, his wife was killed. There was drag racing going on in front of the yeshiva, and she was killed, and there was a man at YU, a bit of a rabble-rouser, a hothead, who declared publicly that this was God's punishment for Professor Feldblum's method of study. And it's a long history, quite fascinating. I hear Gita saying she can't hear me. Does everyone else hear me? You all hear me? Okay, Gita, please be in touch with technical support, and he'll fix it for you. Also, I need to make a clarification, and Gita, your thing probably isn't plugged in. I mentioned, we spoke briefly about Rav Meir Lichtenstein. Here's a picture, incidentally, I found of him. He looks just like his grandfather, the Rav. I said he was at Maale Gilboa. He's actually at Ein Surim. There's a number of yeshivas that are today doing academic Talmud study. One of them is Ein Surim, and we don't have time to discuss it now. Perhaps Rabbi Weider has, but it is worth pondering. Why is it that so many people are today interested in the academic Talmud study? We'll get back to that a little later today with the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. It's as if that the traditional method is not enough. They need something more. And the Rav famously said that were it not for the Brisker method, you could not study Talmud with young people today because they have such advanced secular educations that they need a parallel in terms of Talmudic studies. And there's a critical sense that people are interested in. And finally, with that in mind, let me clarify one more point. Last week we said, and it's true, that Rav Soloveitchik was not interested in academic Talmud study. He didn't see this as part of the mitzvah of study of Talmud. But that doesn't mean he was completely opposed to it. In last week's Yeshiva University commentator, which is put out by the students, there actually was an interview with Herschel Schechter, and he quoted the Rav as saying something very interesting, that he once delivered a lecture in which he mentioned that someone from the seminary, presumably Lieberman, had suggested that during the time of the Tanaim, right after the Second Temple, there must have been a scarcity of wood. And therefore, the Tanaim came up with all sorts of leniencies about how to construct a sukkah to make sure that there'd be enough wood to go around. And someone in the audience declared that this is heresy, that this isn't the sort of thing that the Tanaim are interested in. And Rav Schechter disagreed and said that, Rav Soloveitchik disagreed and said that this might explain the history of the halakha, but it doesn't explain, quote, the mathematical formula for figuring out how the various dinim work. That is, the history might explain why the rabbis were led to do something, but Torah study is what's going to explain to us the rationale, the halakhic basis for it. Whereas from Hirsch's perspective, the whole notion of bringing history in was unacceptable. Now, the Rav wasn't saying that this is study of Talmud, that this is a part of the mitzvah, the kiyum of learning Talmud, but at least he was prepared to acknowledge that history had a role. So with that, we move on. We're on part two of the discussion of Israel Hildesheimer. And we finished last class. I mentioned that the extremists in Hungary, and particularly in Eisenstadt, tried to shut his school down, his yeshiva. They stated that it was allied with the forces of revolution. This is shortly after the 1848 revolution. But Hildesheimer was able to stop it. And in a little while, we'll see some more details of this extremist response. Now, it wasn't just them, though. The reformers also tried to shut down his seminary because they knew, the reformers knew, that if it was just between them and the old-time Orthodox, the old-time Orthodox didn't have a chance. none of the young people wanted to condemn themselves to being the only thing they could do was be a tailor or a merchant. Anyone who wanted to go to the university or wanted to get what we today would call a white-collar job had to be educated, obviously, and that was not something that the old Orthodox were going to provide. Here, Hildesheimer comes in and is able to create an orthodoxy in which one can be part of modern civilization, secular civilization, white-collar profession, and still be Torah observant. It's this which upset the Reformers a great deal. So they polemicized against Hildesheimer, and they argued that any parents who'd send their children to his yeshiva, the secular education was going to be second rate. And I ended the last class by mentioning that was the same argument used when the day school movement really began in the 40s, really in the 1950s. Many parents, and not just non-Orthodox, even an Orthodox who were opposed to the day school movement, and it always came back to the same thing, that the secular education was not going to be up to par. From the beginning, though, the real battle of Hildesheimer was against the Orthodox extremists. Now, who were these? I'm calling them extremists. Who were these Orthodox extremists? Well, for the most part, we're speaking about fanatical Hasidim in Hungary. Hungary has always been a place of extremism, fanaticism, and you had very extreme Hasidim. Now, these Hasidic leaders were, though, great Talmidei Chachamim. In our discussion about the Satmar Rav, I pointed out that unlike the case in Poland, where you had Hasidic rabbis who really were regarded by the non-Hasidim as ignoramuses, amaratzim, these Hasidic rabbis, and you think of great Hasidic leaders from Hungary, were all great scholars. But more important than the Hasidim were the students of the Chasam Sofer. Going back to the very first class in this unit, the beginning of last year, we spoke about the Chasam Sofer, the most important sage in 19th century orthodoxy, perhaps maybe even in the last two centuries. And we saw some of his extremism, his opposition to secular studies, his desire to remain in the ghetto, and we spoke about his notion of chadash asur min haTorah. Anything that is new is forbidden from the Torah. And this was a reactionary viewpoint. The Chasam Sofer was the leader against Mendelssohn's commentary, even though his own father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, wrote an approbation, a haskama, to one of the editions. The Chasam Sofer was completely opposed to preachers in the vernacular. That's chadash, that's new, that's giving into the times. Everything had to be the way it always was, therefore everything had to be in Yiddish. In fact, in his ethical will, given to his community, before he died, he charges the community, never choose a German preacher, only a Yiddish preacher. Now, I mentioned once, a couple semesters ago, that the Ridbaz, the famous Yaakov David Wolofsky, opponent of Rav Kook in the Shemitah year, he became rabbi in Chicago, then went to the land of Israel. He, in one of his volumes, he describes what it's like to be a rabbi in America. And one of the worst things imaginable, he says, is you have these rabbis getting up and preaching in English, something which is totally forbidden, it's giving into the times. And I think I mentioned that I have a friend who likes to be very machmir, like the Ridbaz, that is, if the sermon is not in Yiddish, which no sermons today are, he makes sure to leave. Now, of course, he doesn't even understand Yiddish, but that doesn't take away from the fact that he's very machmir never to listen to any sermons. And he tells people when he's going out, I hold like the Ridbaz, only a few people know what he's talking about. But what is really interesting is that the Chasam Sofer's son, the Ksav Sofer, huge Talmud Chacham, leader of Hungarian Orthodoxy, he chose to disobey his own father's ethical will. And one of the first things he did is he appoints a German preacher. Why would the Ksav Sofer, Rav Avraham Shmuel Sofer, go against his own father? Because he saw where the times were leading, and that the young people were not speaking Yiddish, they were speaking German, they were becoming more modern. In Pressburg, they spoke German, they didn't speak Yiddish. They wore regular suits, not the long coats. This is not a Hasidic town. And he realized that you need to have German preachers there. And, you know, what's wrong with the language? And he argued, of course, that if his father was alive and saw what was going on, he too would agree. And they hired a German preacher. This led to massive assaults against the Ksav Sofer by Rav Chasam Sofer's other students. The same people who we'll see in a minute were attacking Hildesheimer. Rav Hillel Lichtenstein, who was the head of the extremist Hungarians, also a student of the Chasam Sofer, published a book called Beit Hillel. Here's a copy, a reprint in Williamsburg a few years ago. And in there, he has a couple responses addressed to Pressburg. They begin like the Book of Lamentations. How is it that a wonderful city, Pressburg, has fallen so low? And now there's a German preacher, which is as if an idol in the middle of the Chasam Sofer's territory. The second thing, though, the Kassav Sofer did, which infuriated the extremists, is he invited Israel Hildesheimer to come to Pressburg from Eisenstadt and serve as co-rabbi. So Pressburg would now have two rabbis, the Kassav Sofer, who would be the posek, the traditionalist, and Israel Hildesheimer, who would be the more modern rabbi, able to speak to the younger generation with the doctorate. This was infuriating. As we know, remember in Megillas Esther, after Haman is caught with Esther, Ahasuerus comes in. Ahasuerus replies that he wants to conquer the queen in his own house. The idea that you'd have a German preacher and you have a rabbi doctor preaching a Torim Derech Eretz philosophy in the rabbi's own house, in Pressburg, the seat of the Chasam Sofer, that was infuriating to the extremists. And there are tshuvot, there are letters in this volume directed against Hildesheimer, whereas the volumes directed towards the Kassav Sofer are of the sort, how disappointed we are that the very son of the Kassav Sofer would do such a terrible thing. When it comes to Hildesheimer, he is called a heretic, no holds barred. He is an evil man, a heretic, one determined to uproot and totally destroy Judaism. He is no different than Geiger. The language used against Hildesheimer is positively shocking. And the two figures writing these letters are Rav Hillel Lichtenstein. Often, if you read his name in rabbinic literature, it's Hillel Lash, Lamed Squiggly Mark Shin. That's Lichtenstein. And Chaim Sofer, who's known as the Machane Chaim, a big Talmud Chacham, but an extremist. The son-in-law of Hillel Lichtenstein happens to be the late Ivri, Rav Akiva Schlesinger. Now, these extremists also blasted Eisenstadt, that Hildesheimer had a yeshiva in Eisenstadt that taught secular studies. There were some, however, who were friendly with Hildesheimer, the Maram Shik, maybe the greatest of the Chasam Sofer's disciples, Rav Yehuda Asod, who author of the Tshuvas Mari Asod. He sent his son to study with the Chasam Sofer. But most still were opposed to him, and some of them even came to Hildesheimer, the ones who didn't regard him as a completely evil person, and they complained to him that everything he's doing, these new things, yeshivas, the secular studies, everyone is talking about him. No one can understand how a Talmud Chacham like Hildesheimer could do this sort of thing. And, you know, they're being, all the great rabbis of Hungary, he's told, are being bothered day and night. They can't get, you know, what's Hildesheimer doing? And Hildesheimer replied to them as follows. There's no doubt that it's Hildesheimer who said this. He said, "The time that you rabbis spend talking about me and how bad I am, it's during that time that I'm doing all my secular studies. In other words, the time you're wasting talking Lashon Hara about me, that's the time I'm doing secular studies." Now, I say this goes like Hildesheimer because it does, although someone told me, I didn't see the Rabbi Soloveitchik movie yet, that the same quote is attributed to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now, he might have said it, you know, he probably heard it, and therefore he said the same thing to the people who criticized him, although it's possible that it's just a legend, but it really did happen with Hildesheimer. What did the extremists then decide to do? Well, they set up a conference. Originally, it was supposed to be 71 rabbis like a Sanhedrin. It turned out to be more. In Michalovice, it's a city in Hungary, and you had, I guess you'd say, the whole extremist rabbinate was there, and that includes, incidentally, the Rav Shlomo Gansfried, the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. If you've ever wondered, growing up, it seems like a bit of an extreme book in certain places. He was one of the extremist rabbis. The Maram Shik refused to attend. Mari Asad refused to attend. Of course, the Kassav Sofer refused to attend. It was mostly some extremist mitnagdim and chassidim. And what was the point of this gathering? It was to set down the law. What is permitted in Hungarian Jewry? They made a group of decrees. I think it was 8 decrees or 9 decrees, binding on all of Jewry, or at the very least on Hungarian Jewry. One of these decrees was that there was to be no German preachers. anyone who preached in German, you know, they allowed German preaching. Their community was not to be regarded as Orthodox. No, no, the Hungarian in Pressburg, if you've been, it's very close to Vienna. It's maybe an hour of a train from Vienna. So it's very much a Germanic culture. Today it's a Bratislava. It's in Slovakia. So they did not speak Hungarian there. It was also a Hungarian Empire, but they spoke German. Only the Hungarian sections were the ones who spoke. They wouldn't have spoke Hungarian anyway. They would have spoken Slovakian or something. But the lingua franca for the educated classes was all German. And Chassam Sofer's son-in-law was the rabbi in Vienna, and one of his other students. Now, the Maram Shik has a tshuva about this. He says, what's the problem with preaching in German? Granted, the Chassam Sofer didn't like it, but today, that's the way to reach the people. What's wrong with the language? But he also felt that he couldn't stand up against them because there were so many, and as we'll see in a minute, Hildesheimer did not feel as much. They also decreed that you could not have choirs. Last night in West Orange, we heard the Park East Choir. They had a whole concert, the Park East Synagogue Choir, together with maybe the greatest chazan in the world, Yitzhak Helfgott. They declared that choirs are absolutely forbidden. Either they're taken from Christians, or if they're not taken from Christians, they're not an authentically Jewish thing. I mean, because in theory, the Levites were a choir. But today, we don't have choirs. The Christians do it. So anyone having a choir is trying to imitate the Christians. Any synagogue with a choir is a forbidden synagogue. You cannot step foot in it. It's a place of heresy. Another decree, clerical robes, heresy. In Germany, the practice was that the rabbis wore clerical robes. We discussed this. And on, decree after decree. Now, the Maram Shik didn't feel like he could go up against all these rabbis because many of them were students of the Chassam Sofer. He disagreed with them, but he said, you know, I don't agree with them, but what am I going to do? It's not for me to argue with them. Hildesheimer didn't think so. Hildesheimer, basically, you see here the beginnings of the notion of Das Torah, that the rabbis can make decrees that bind everyone, even those who are not regarded as their followers. Hildesheimer responded very sharply, though. He published an open letter, it's really an essay, in Hebrew and German. And the first thing he said is that because these rabbis were saying, we are the majority, and there's no question that in Hungary, the extremist rabbis were a majority. Hildesheimer said, there's no such thing as a majority. If I'm right, I'm in the majority. That was his attitude. Like the old, I mentioned it last semester, the old Abraham Lincoln story where he was at a cabinet meeting and he went around the room. Who says I? Everyone raises their hand. Who says no? He raises their hand. The no's have it. You know, if you're right, you're in the majority. What Hildesheimer said was that we no longer have a Sanhedrin. I am a rabbi. I do not have to be bound by your declarations. And he establishes there something which is very important to remember. That no matter how many great rabbis are out there making all sorts of decrees, another rabbi does not have to listen to it. Another rabbi is not bound to it. We no longer have a Sanhedrin. We no longer have a Beit Din HaGadol. No group of rabbis can force another rabbi. The fact that Hildesheimer was the only rabbi in Hungary to stand up against all these others was irrelevant, he said, because each rabbi has to be guided by their own conscience. And he blasted the decrees, which he thought were not based on halakha, except for one or two, as I'll mention. There were two areas he did agree with. One was the need for high mechitzas. The minhag in Germany was mechitzah where you couldn't see the women. In fact, they didn't have mechitzas in Germany. In Germany, women sat up high, and you couldn't see the women. If you looked up and stuck your head out and looked dead, you could see them. But if you're in shul and you're looking straight ahead, you can't see the women. Then they started putting mechitzas down the same level. And by the way, even in Germany, they often had lattice work, so you couldn't see the women. In Germany, the minhag was, though, that you should not see the women at all. In Hungary, also that was. In Lithuania, they weren't so mocked on it. And obviously, look around today. And Ramosha Feinstein had a big debate against the Satmar Rav about this. It comes down to whether you think the issue of mechitza is not to see the women, in which case the mechitza has to be high, or if it's not to mix. And then you could have a mechitza like Lincoln Square Synagogue in New York, in which it's just a see-through glass. It's not a one-way glass. It's just glass. And you could be right next to a woman with the glass separating you. It comes down to a difference between the Rambam. In his Perushta Mishnah, he mentions seeing, But in his mission, Torah, he mentions mixing, that that's why the men and women were separated in the temple. And all the great Lithuanian poskim go with the notion that's the Mishnah Torah, that it's you don't mix. And therefore we have the debates, you know, how high does the mechitza need to be? Rav Soloveitchik thought 42 inches as the basic minimum. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein thought 50 inches. And as you know, if you know Orthodoxy, they just keep getting higher and higher. But fundamentally, the issue is not to mix. But that was not the minhag in Hungary. And Hildesheimer actually agreed that rabbis in Hungary who wanted to take down the mechitza, so the women, bring the women down to the same level and lower the mechitza, he said it's improper. The problem, of course, is obvious. If women are up in the balcony, they could see what's going on. If you have mechitzas where women are at the same level, we understand why they have to lower the mechitzas, because otherwise women cannot see anything that's going on. Maybe also the husbands can't see when their wives come in to show. But the real reason is then the women can hear and not see, and the women won't stand for that. What women? So therefore you have the idea of a one-way glass. But that's only because you're holding the notion that women shouldn't be seen. What was the other decree he agreed with? Organ. The Hungarian said you cannot bring an organ into the shul, even to be played by a Gentile. It didn't matter. You can't have an organ. So that was a reformist trait. Every reformist synagogue had an organ. However, what about all the other decrees? He opposed some of them, but he didn't feel that they turned the shul into a reform shul. For example, there were some synagogues, believe it or not, that were building steeples. And the Hungarian decrees said that any synagogue that builds a steeple is the equivalent of a reformist synagogue and you can't go into it. Hildesheimer said that while it's certainly distasteful to build a steeple, the fact is if a synagogue is fool enough to build a steeple, it doesn't mean you can't go there to daven. Understand, when they say you can't go there, that means it's Rosh Hashanah, you can't go there to hear the shofar. He says, no, you can still go there. It's, as he said, quote, architecture does not make the synagogue, but the genuine Jewish spirit that resides in there. No decrees regarding chazanis except for the choir. Chazans in those days all liked to have a choir, and they said that choirs are absolutely forbidden. Now, despite, well, let me mention, oh, he also, incidentally, I'll tell you, was against the, he didn't care for the robes, the clerical robes, but again, that's not halacha, that's minhag. I'll get back to that in a minute. Despite his willingness to defend his ideas, it was clear to him that the extremism in Hungary was too powerful, and he would never be able to win. I mean, he'd be spend his entire life fighting against it. So you can imagine how pleased he was when he received an invitation from the Orthodox community in Berlin to come there and open a yeshiva, just like he had in Eisenstadt in Berlin. Now, in the following years, from the time he leaves, was the 1860s, until really World War II, Hungary is a very inhospitable place for what we might call modern Orthodoxy. Anyone who tries to advocate such a philosophy was subjected to withering criticism. The Agudas Yisrael never got off the ground in Hungary. It was put in Cheirem. So if the Agudas Yisrael, which was the Orthodox movement of Lithuania and Poland, was considered treif, you can imagine what Mizrahi and modern Orthodoxy was. Hungary came to be dominated by what we would consider extremist Hasidut, but also, again, it's a different type of Hasidut in Poland. Great learners, but extremism. Among those who had a more liberal approach, I'll just mention just two names. One is Rav Shlomo Schick. His grandson was a rabbi in the Upper East Side. Some of you might know the name Alexander Schick. And his kid, this Alexander Schick's sons went to Lakewood and everything. We're talking about the Rav of the city of Kartsug. He wrote volumes of Tshuvot, but he was regarded as an outcast because he had a liberal philosophy of secular studies. The German poskim quote him. The Hungarians will never quote him. And if anyone knows Adam Furziger, it's worth noting that he wrote his master's dissertation on Rav Shlomo Schick, and it's titled A Moderate in a Sea of Extremism. Another moderate, also a great Zionist, was Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, known as the Dor Revii. He became a Zionist, and worse than becoming a modern Orthodox turned Derech Eretz was to become a Zionist. And most of the rabbis turned against him, and some of his own students turned against him. This is the Dor Revii, the fourth generation from the Chasam Sofer, and it created a huge feud in his city of Kloisenberg Kluj. The city split into two. And there was no future there. And in 1924, as I said, the Separatist Kahila was formed, and he had to go on Aliyah. So extremism was really the norm in Hungary. I asked Professor Twersky, what is it about extremism that produces this? And he said he has no answer. And I'll tell you, that is a tshuva of the Bach. This goes back a couple hundred years before there's any Hasidut or anything. And he talks, even then, in the 1600s, that Hungary is a place of extremism. So I don't know if it's in the water, or if I don't know if the Christians have extremism, but it's always had extremism, not just extremist orthodoxy, extremist reform. I mean, real extremists, like German-style extremist reform. Aaron Horan, you know, the first reformer, extremist reformer, comes from there. So I really don't know. Having said that, there were great people who came from Hungary, who left Hungary, went to Germany, went to the land of Israel, and were not extremists. But they felt that they had to leave Hungary if they wanted to, you know, have a rabbinic impact elsewhere. We know people who sent their children to study in, let's say, the Szabadka Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva, from Hungary because they wanted a more liberal environment than was found in Hungary. You should know the Pressburg Yeshiva was thought to be a very liberal place. They had secular, the students went to secular school as well. That was off limits. For the Hungarian Orthodox, the Pressburg Yeshiva was considered off limits. It was much more in line with a Western Yeshiva, and many people from Germany and other places went there. Now let me return to Hildesheimer then. He had been in Hungary for 18 years, and he was very happy when he had a chance to leave, because living there was very difficult. In one letter he wrote, explaining why he wants to leave, he says, quote, "I live in a very small, uncultured place." And truth be told, for all the opposition of the Hasidim to him, he was opposed to the Hasidim. In his private letters, he criticizes them as being closed-minded and extremist, fanatical. So it really was not a good match for him in Hungary. What was the situation like in Berlin? It was the same as in Frankfurt. There was a general community, and the Orthodox felt like their needs were not being met. So as in Frankfurt, they formed a separatist community. That means members of the general community, everyone paying taxes to belong to the general community, also were willing to pay out of their own pockets additional monies to support this new rabbi and his yeshiva. In fact, before Hildesheimer came to Berlin, Geiger was hired as a community rabbi in Berlin. Shortly before that, the Orthodox wanted, instead of Geiger, they wanted Hildesheimer to be hired, but the reformers dominated. The problem Hildesheimer had in leaving was that what was to become of his yeshiva? He came, he started this yeshiva 18 years before, and now there were 150 students, and he felt as if he had a responsibility. Students were coming from all over Hungary, and he was giving them enlightenment. He was creating rabbis who could deal with the trends, the modern times. And if he were to leave, the yeshiva would disintegrate. And the little yeshiva that he was going to be given in Berlin, he'd have to start from scratch. There were 20 boys learning it. And the people in Berlin wanted him to do in Berlin just what he had done in Eisenstadt. But he left. He took some of his students with him, W.C. Hoffman, who will begin next week, the most famous, and the other yeshiva students could have gone to Pressburg, or they could have, but he felt like he had to leave. He needed a new challenge. He comes, in addition to the yeshiva, he immediately creates a religious school for boys and girls. There were no schools there, religious schools for girls. He also establishes the first Orthodox rabbinical seminary. So the boys' school is the yeshiva, and a rabbinical seminary. Now, what's a rabbinical seminary? How does that differ from yeshiva? I'm not going to repeat everything we said last week, but for those who weren't here, let me just say, a yeshiva is where you sit and learn, no goals. I told the joke last week about the guy in Lakewood for 10 years. When the cop stops him and asks him how long he's in the yeshiva, he says 10 years, and the cops reply, "You must be the stupidest person there. It's 10 years, and you still haven't graduated." And that's the point. You don't graduate from yeshiva. But a seminary has as a goal, you want to become a rabbi. There's coursework, there's a whole curriculum, and that's what he wanted to establish. In Hungary, rabbinical seminaries were banned. Why did they ban rabbinical seminaries? Chadash asher min haTorah. It's new. What do you have to train rabbis in preaching and in history and philosophy. A rabbi needs to sit and study and learn poskim and yoredeya, and when it's time to get a job, he gets a job. We don't train people in proper elocution and things like that. I mean, their attitude was, and it's only half joking, that you say the rabbi needs to speak well. All these people in Germany and Hungary, they want rabbis who can speak well. Or in America and Canada, we all want rabbis who can speak well. The rabbis come and they give these drushas. You know something? If Moshe Rabbeinu came, he never would get the job. Because doesn't the Torah tell us he couldn't speak well? So for the traditionalists, the fact that he couldn't speak well was not a problem. Not to mention the fact that, what, they spoke twice a year, they gave a drusha, no one understood. That wasn't the issue. But in modern times, people wanted preachers. They wanted a rabbi to preach every Shabbos. That's what the non-Jews did. That's what they wanted. So preaching became very important. And the seminary trained preachers. And if you're a preacher and you're preaching to educated people, you need to, it's not just enough. You can't get up and just speak about Tosfos and Rambam. You need to speak about history. You need to speak about politics. You need to know about Jewish philosophy. You need to be well-trained all around. And therefore, since you're not going to get that in the yeshiva, you have to open a rabbinical seminary. In addition to that, it was expected at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary that every student would go for a doctorate. In Germany, every rabbi had to be a rabbiner doctor. Why? Not because they needed to be educated. I mean, you could be, Hirsch was educated, he wasn't a doctor. You could be plenty educated simply by taking courses. But in Germany, there was an expectation. People wanted that. Now, a PhD in Germany is not the same as in America. It's perhaps more like the equivalent of a master's. But the title was very important, especially since all the Protestant preachers were reverend doctors. The rabbis also needed to be that. And remember, in Germany, by the way, lawyers are also called doctors. So you had many medical doctors. You had many lawyers who were called doctors. You had many people. And they put a lot of respect into secular subjects. They thought that the rabbi has to be the equal. So the rabbi will be the rabbi and the doctor. Now, where did they go for these degrees? Most of them went, or many of them went, to the University of Berlin, which if you've been to Berlin, you'll know it's very close to the rabbinical seminary. But some went to Vienna, some went to Tübingen, or Gießen even. Many places throughout Germany to get their doctorates. Some even went overseas. Yeah, went to other countries, but I wouldn't say overseas. But there was some who went to Budapest. But for the most part, Heidelberg was a big place. They all went to get their doctorates. This meant, incidentally, that many people had to be turned away. We know that many students from Hungary wanted to come, and many students from Russia. Hildesheimer himself writes how they had to turn away many students because, just like Yeshiva University today, you need a BA. You need to have graduated from gymnasium. That's the equivalent of high school, you know, in America, before you went to the rabbinical seminary. So these guys were coming from Russia. They would just show up at the seminary doors, never having had any secular education, but they wanted to be an enlightened rabbi. They were turned away because here everyone coming in is already at the level to go for their doctorate. And these people had never even attended high school. What's the point, though? Why is it so valuable? Well, according to Hildesheimer, there are problems in the modern world. And these problems can only be solved by modern rabbis. What is YU? YU is a yeshiva with a university attached. And the two really have nothing to do with each other. Rav Soloveitchik, in fact, has a famous lecture in which he talks about how Yeshiva University is volozhin, it's a real yeshiva, and it's a university. But there's no synthesis. In the seminary, the whole idea was to be a synthesis. And Hildesheimer, in his own life, modeled this. A synthesis of Torah and secular studies. The two were supposed to be joined together. And that's how things were until Kristallnacht, when the seminary was closed. The only, I guess, parallel today would be Yeshivas Chovei Torah, which is a rabbinical seminary in which the faculty supports the whole idea of integration of secular subjects and religious subjects. That doesn't mean that YCT has anything to do with the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary in terms of its hashkafa, but just the model of a rabbinical seminary, the only one we have today is Yeshivas Chovei Torah. Now, the seminary believed in the academic study of Judaism, and this caused them to get into a great dispute, like we said last week, with Hirsch. traditional Talmud study has to be pursued, but unlike Rabbi Weider, if I understood correctly what you said last, someone said last week that traditional Talmud study is for the Beit Midrash and academic study is not. This was supposed to be joined. Traditional Talmud study and academic Talmud study are both for the Beit Midrash. Yes, about YU. YU saw it as a synthesis. He wrote about it. In fact, Belkin did and Revel did also. But none of the Rosh Yeshiva ever did. Finally, one Rosh Yeshiva who thought of it as a synthesis. The only one you could think of would be the Rav, and the Rav is explicit that it's not a synthesis. So you have the interesting situation of the only people who think it's a synthesis are the president and the people who put out the propaganda at the publicity office. But certainly none of the secular teachers believe it is. They're not even Jewish, half of them. And none of the rabbi, Rosh Yeshiva, think it's a synthesis. So in the end of the day, it's not a synthesis. But in the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, that was the raison d'etre, that was the goal, to be a synthesis. They thought that that had religious value, and you can see the Sri D.H. in an essay he has in Leif Rakim, in which he actually uses the word synthesa, synthesis. I mean, the Rav thought that it's better not to be a synthesis, that Torah is in its own world, and secular subjects are in its own world, and that's the highest level. They thought differently in Germany. Now, I've already spoken, I'm not going to get into it again, about traditional Talmud study versus academic. We spoke about it the first few minutes as well today. I will say, though, what about Bible? They had great scholars at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary who taught things like Akkadian. You know, you see these words that aren't clear in the Bible, words that they're called pleonasms, they appear one time. How do you know what they mean? Well, Hirsch had a whole speculative etymology in which he compared Hebrew. It wasn't a scientific etymology, but he compared one word to another. That wasn't, in Berlin, they wanted nothing about this. If you want to know these rare Hebrew words, you look in the Arabic. You look in Akkadian. You look in all these other languages. You try to use cognate words. They taught archaeology in the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. These are the sorts of things that were valuable, they thought, for illuminating the Torah and Tanakh using modern scholarship. But as far as Hirsch was concerned, we're irrelevant. From Hirsch's standpoint, we continue learning Torah the way we always did. The only problem is, Hirsch saw, is that the focus was always on Talmud. And Hirsch wanted to put the focus back on Tanakh and study of prayer, things of that nature. But we still will study Tanakh the same way it's been studied. We don't need these outside, outer disciplines. Today, I think the issue is not so much the archaeology or the comparative linguistics, but if you know what's taking place in Israel from Machon Herzog and elsewhere, they're using modern literary theory to study Tanakh, Torah, you have Yoel Ben Nun, you have Samet, you have all the rest of them, and that is a new form of study, and if you're a traditionalist, you wouldn't like that either. Doctrine in general was far wider in Berlin than it was in Frankfurt. We're going to discuss this at length next class or the class after with regard to Hoffman and his great battle with Hirsch. But let's go back to another figure who I mentioned briefly, Yaakov Barth. There are two figures who the Hirschians zoomed in on to show that the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was treif. They thought it was a puzzle institution, an unacceptable institution. And why? Well, it wasn't the idea of a rabbinical seminary per se. That wasn't Hirsch's problem. It was the way Torah was studied there. One of the reasons was David C. Hoffman, and the other was Yaakov Barth. So let me repeat again, Yaakov Barth. Who was Barth? Well, first of all, he was one of the world's leading Semitic scholars. You had great Semitic scholars in Berlin. Another one, some of you might know the name, Eugen Mittwoch. He died, he got out of Germany before the World War II, and he ended up in London. I think he died in 1940 or 41. He was maybe the greatest Arabic scholar in Berlin in his day. The Rav Soloveitchik talks about him in one of his famous, another famous lecture of Soloveitchik. See, Rav Soloveitchik had a great deal of respect, even awe, for the German Orthodox, even though he saw the problems in that there wasn't advanced Talmud study of the sort he was attuned to. But he told the story how the University of Berlin on Tisha B'Av, by the way, it shows you that the Rav was at the University on Tisha B'Av, that Eugen Mittwoch, who was a member of Hildesheimer's separatist Orthodox community, used to come to the University of Berlin on Tisha B'Av with an unshaved face. This has been already the 9 days or even maybe 3 weeks. Unshaved face and with slippers on. And the Rav said that showed him what real piety was. and pride to come to the University of Berlin, where everything was so prim and proper, with an unshaven face and wearing house shoes, stepshik, I think is a shekshik, I don't know the Yiddish expression he used, but it means house shoes. And the Rav was very impressed by this. And these are the sort of figures. We're talking about incredible piety combined with incredible academic excellence. Yaakov Barth was like a predecessor for Eugen Mitzvah, one of the world's leading scholars of Semitic languages. And he also taught at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. What was the problem then with him? Well, for one, his etymology. He wrote books, and how do you analyze where these words come from in Tanakh? Look at the Arabic, look at the other, look at the parallel languages. The authorship of various books. He did not accept the Talmudic authorships. He was an advocate of the second Isaiah theory and of other books. He taught the Song of Songs as a love song, which was later adopted and turned into, through interpretation, an allegory, but fundamentally, originally, it was not an allegory, it was a love song. And truth be told, one of the Breuers wrote a whole book which got him in a lot of trouble, Rafael Breuer, interpreting Song of Songs as a love song. Because what's wrong with love between man and woman? That book he wrote, Rafael Breuer, was one of the reasons he was not chosen as rabbi of Frankfurt when his father died, Shlomo Zalman Breuer. Instead, they went with the Rav Horovitz, the Unsdorfer Rav. The major reason was because he broke ranks with the Orthodox and did something they thought was semi-heretical, published a commentary interpreting the Song of Songs literal. I think today people would say, well, that's very nice. Love between a man and a woman, that's holy. What's wrong with reading the Song of Songs that way? But in Germany, it wasn't the case. So Barth was the subject of great dispute and attacks from the Hirschians. The claim was made that this is the exact problem with modern academic studies. You take something traditional, the Song of Songs, traditional authorships, traditional way of study, and you bring in the academic pursuit. Well, from Barth's perspective, they both are valuable, and why should we stop? Why should we close our eyes if we can benefit from some of the knowledge of the academic approach, etymologies, history? Why should we close ourselves off? The Rambam never closed himself off. The Talmudic rabbis didn't close himself off. But, of course, the argument from the other side was that you remove the holiness from the text. And for those of you who know the Dat Mikra Tanakh series, I'll leave it to each of your judgment. When you read Dat Mikra, do you think it takes away from Kedusha and from traditional learning, or do you think it supplements and adds to it? I can tell you that many people feel the latter, but many people feel the former as well, and the Hirschians were on the former. The Dat Mikra series follows in the path of people like Hildesheimer, Barth, Mitzvach, and Hoffman. Barth never wrote the Shir HaShirim commentary. Rafael Breuer was forced to he rewrote a second version of it, and this version, if I'm not mistaken, even was translated into the English. But the original one, the one that got him into all the trouble, was never translated. So there are, I mention this in my book. And incidentally, those who want more information on German Orthodoxy, there's two books I recommend. One is my book on Rabbi Weinberg, in which I do discuss the Barth episode with the Song of Songs. And the other is David Ellenson, who wrote a wonderful book on Israel Hildesheimer. It's very interesting because he's a Reform rabbi, the head of Hebrew Union College, and he has a real insight into Orthodoxy. Since you mentioned Breuer and the Song of Songs, it's ironic because the Breuers were the strongest opponents of religious Zionism, and they attacked it, and they hated it. So Rev Reines, in one of his books, finally had a chance to get revenge, because after this book on Shir HaShirim was published, he writes, well, what do you expect from these people? These are the people who oppose Zionism. It shows that they're not really tied to Torah and Kedusha, and that's why they don't sense the love of Eretz Yisrael. And Haraya, what's the proof? Here he writes a parish on the Song of Songs and interprets it literally. There was another difference. Oh, by the way, the only thing off-limits to people like Barth was the Pentateuch. No higher criticism of the Torah. That's off-limits. And men like Barth and Hoffman became the strongest opponents of Wellhausen. But when it came to Nach, they said there is no issues of fundamentals here, there's no Ikar, Yesod HaAmuna, there's nothing that tells us that we cannot examine the books of Nach in a more critical sense, look at authorship, other things. Torah, we have a tradition. It's Mosaic authorship. That's different. Nach, we don't have anywhere written in our faith that you must believe that Jeremiah or that Isaiah wrote the whole book. What's so terrible, they said, if you think that another prophet added on chapters at the end. That's, we're not concerned about the author, per se, as much about the message and the Nevuah. That's what Barth said. So we have a local Mocher Sforim who said he can't sell Torah Chaim. I don't know what would be the problem with the Torah Chaim, other than the fact that maybe the Rashi is not in Rashi's script. There's no critical comments in Torah Chaim. Torah Chaim simply puts the standard commentaries into a more readable, accessible thing. Now, if you're going to say because it's published by Mosad Hav Kook, that doesn't make sense either, because the most Haredi yeshivas have all the Mosad Hav Kook books. So I'm not sure what would be the problem with selling the Torah Chaim, but I would understand if you don't mean, if by mistake you mean instead of Torah Chaim, which is the big blue books, if you mean the Da'at Mikra series, which is the pink volumes, then I understand, because those are an attempt to integrate traditional scholarship. And in the introductions to all the volumes, you'll see they discuss authorship. They'll give the traditional views, the Talmudic views, and the more critical views. And this was put out under the Haskamas of Rav Mordechai Breuer, of Shaul Yisraeli, and others. So Rabbi Kamel, we have to determine, does he really mean Torah Chaim, or does he mean the other one? Bar-Ilan University, that's good you say this. Since you mentioned it, let me say, Bar-Ilan University and YU Rebbe Graduate School follow directly from the Hildesheim Rabbinical Seminary. Hildesheim Rabbinical Seminary was the first Orthodox institution to raise these type of questions and these issues. And if you go to Bar-Ilan or Revel, again, Torah off limits. But everything else is on limits. Critical histories of Jewish, of medieval times, of Talmudic times, of Jewish philosophy, all these things. If any of you took Chaim Soloveitchik, the sort of research in Halacha he does, or Yaakov Katz, or Ephraim Orbach, I mean, this all comes out of the Hildesheimer tradition. And although at Bar-Ilan, it's a standard feature, at YU, you've had the problems. You know about the battles with Rav Schechter and Professor Feldblum and the other Rashi Yeshiva. But at Bar-Ilan, I don't believe they've had those problems. Okay, so now we hear that it's dry, the Da'at Mikra. In a sense, I would say, you're right, Da'at Mikra reduces the traditional, old-fashioned feeling. I think what they would say to you today is that many people don't have that feeling to begin with. Also, they might say that all heart and no head is not always so good. You know, you need to have a little head also, and that if people feel the Kedusha's reduced, maybe they need to have a more sophisticated approach. In any event, not everything is for everyone. Some people, Da'at Mikra is not for them. Other people, it is for them. I mean, the rabbinical seminary never said their approach is for everyone. Shivim Panim LaTorah. There's 70 different approaches to Torah. But Da'at Mikra is another one. It follows directly from the, and this is the people working on it come out of the German Orthodox tradition. Yes, people look for Haskamot first and content later. Well, if you're looking for Haskamot, I will tell you that the Da'at Mikra has Haskamot of Mordechai Breuer, and also Rochelle Yisraeli. They were on the editorial board. You don't need them to put, you know, Haskamot in the front. On the very first, second page, it says that they're at the editorial board, and everything had to go by them. So for the religious Zionist community, that's Haskamot. In general, there's a difference. The tradition, the modern Orthodox community has now developed a whole school of Tanakh studies. This begins in Machon Herzog in Israel. You have now Chovei Torah puts on, you know, Tanakh. The traditional, you have that convention for 2 days. I know Rabbi Kelman at Torah in Motion, you'll have experts speak on Tanakh. This is not traditional, though. In a traditional world, you're a posek, you're a Rosh Hashiva, a great Rav. I mean, primarily, you know Shas, and then, okay, so you'll speak about Torah. I mean, but the idea that you can be a specialist in Tanakh, that's not something that the traditional world, the yeshiva world, knows anything about. You have a Rav, and he knows Chumash. In the modern world, we now have specialists because we believe that there's different genres, and people could be specialists, and it's important also because it allows women to be involved, because women are kept out pretty much of Gemara because it takes so long to become an expert in Gemara, and so many yeshivas are kept out, but this gives women a chance to become expert in something. Not that they can't become expert in Gemara, but Tanakh, many women are drawn to, and in the traditional world, if you know the traditional world, women, the only thing they can do is they'll speak to other women about, you know, maybe how to raise children and maybe some very Torah light, but you don't have women doing serious Torah study. So there's no question that what the modern Orthodox religious Zionists do now with Tanakh as a field, that's not traditional any more, though, than the Rambam was traditional with philosophy or the Maharal. What the Maharal did was not traditional. I mean, Kabbalah was not traditional before it became traditional. So the idea, when I say it's not traditional, I mean it wasn't done in Lithuania in the 19th century. But the fact is it was done in medieval Spain. The Ibn Ezra didn't write Talmudic commentaries. The Radak didn't write Talmudic commentaries. They focused on Tanakh. So when we say it's new, it's really new-old, or old-new, because these experts on Tanakh are really bringing back the whole medieval school of Parshanut HaMikra, Rav Yosef Kara, and all the greats, the Abarbanel. I mean, I know the Rav said the Abarbanel was not part of our Masorah, but what can I tell you? Yeah.
Yeah. Can I just say for Seth?
Yeah.
It's also not just the Sedia Tanakh, it's the whole, you know, I know I came a little bit late, but it's the whole methodology of how the mood setting Tanakh in the modern Orthodox world, the sort of more literal readings, the reading sort of without meter shade, in addition, not...
Yes, no,
Tanakh,
Rabbi Kelman's
the whole approach is very different.
Yeah, Rabbi Kelman's saying, maybe, and there's been disputes, there's this idea of Govei Naim, I mean, how to view the greats of the past. Do you look at Abraham and try to examine him like you would a person in Hamlet, you know, and try to find faults? And that's a big debate. And also using tools of modern literature, literary analysis to examine Chumash. Mordechai Breuer was, that was his big thing. He started a whole school. But really, that was what Ibn Ezra was doing. That's what Abarbanel is doing in Radak. They're using... But there's no question it's different. And I don't know if a traditionalist reading them would... I don't know if he makes sense of it. Now, some other questions. The average person don't know these names. Well, see, I don't know. I don't know who the average person is. I can tell you that in Eretz Yisrael, where the Haredim and the religious Zionist world are totally separate, the average religious Zionist not only knows the name Mordechai Breuer, Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, reveres the name Mordechai Breuer. Rishal Yisraeli, I mean, he was the most important Rav in the religious Zionist world, at least the right-wing religious Zionist world for many years. So it's true, in Chutz La'aretz, many people don't know the name, because in Chutz La'aretz, because all the Zionist rabbis are in Israel, so we don't hear these names. But these are very important figures, and certainly anyone who's learned in Hezder, has been in Israel, knows the name of Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. He passed away last year, revolutionized the study of Tanakh. If you know the name Yoel Ben Nun or Elchanan Samet and others, I mean, they're a whole school, Menachem Liebtag. I mean, these names would have been unimaginable without the revolution in Tanakh study. So it's hard to know. If people don't know these names, then I encourage them to find out about these names because it's a very different type of Tanakh study. Now, when you say women, Nechama Leibowitz, you're right, but Nechama Leibowitz doesn't come out of she comes out of the German Orthodox world, even though she herself comes from Riga, Latvia, but she comes out of the German Orthodox world. She taught at Michala, so obviously this is an example of the religious Zionist world allowing a woman to succeed. She was the first, although her approach is a traditional approach. She's not using any of these new literary methods. I was with Nechama Leibowitz when I was in BMT. She used to teach there. In fact, the year I was there, that's when Rav Shach came out with his decree that it was forbidden for her to teach. I mean, it was a very strange decree. She wasn't teaching in B'nai Brak. Came back with a very sharp thing that she told people that she knows more Tanakh than Rav Shach, and therefore he has no right to tell her to teach. And I have no doubt that she knew a lot more Tanakh. Rav Shach was an expert in Shas and Poskim. But she was very influential as well. And she taught at the religious Zionist institutions. Many people went to Gruss. Anyone who's over 40 and went to Gruss in Jerusalem, she was the standard Tanakh teacher. Someone shaking their hand. Okay, the Malbum was a woman. Is that a joke? what can I say? No, the Malbum was not a woman, but the Malbum's approach is certainly used by Nachabon Leibowitz often. Aviva Zornberg, there's an example of a woman. There are women, though, who couldn't publish under their real name. Do you know that Rav Lichtenstein's mother published an essay in the Tel's Yeshiva Journal under a pseudonym because she was a woman? And okay, let's move on. There was another
under
a man's name, yeah. There was another difference between Hirsch and Hilda Simer, and this is also fundamental, how they viewed secular studies. Hirsch, we spoke about. Secular studies are essential. There has to be this love of secular studies. You're not a complete person if you're living in the ghetto. Our job is to conquer the world, bring Torah to bear on every aspect of human civilization. The ghetto is something we were forced into, and we don't deserve to be there, and we don't want to be there. Hildesheimer had a different approach. For Hildesheimer, the ghetto was fine. There's nothing wrong with Torah only. In theory, if we could have a ghetto again and we could live in that world, there wouldn't be anything wrong with it. For Hirsch, that shows you're an uncultured person, you're not fulfilling your mission in life. Jews are not meant to be in ghettos. Hildesheimer said, in today's day and age, it's impossible to be in a ghetto. We've already been let out of the ghetto. There's no turning back. The modern world beckons. In modern times, we must create this. And he didn't even really believe in a synthesis. He believed in a synthesis of academic Torah study, but not of secular studies. He believed in being educated, because we have to be in the modern world. But the idea that you cannot be a cultured Jew without being involved in the world, for him, it was much more utilitarian. And why do you study science? What's so valuable about it? Well, first, you don't want to be ignorant. You're in the modern world. But also, it's not valuable per se. It helps you better understand sugyos and shas. If you know mathematics, you can understand Masechet Kinim. For Hirsch, it's all utilitarian. He doesn't have this romantic view of the Torah and the secular joining. For Jews in Germany and Hungary, of course, they need to be educated. This is the modern world. And that was the Rav Soloveitchik's approach. But if you're living in the middle of the ghetto in Vilna, you don't need to be educated. If it turns out that if you don't get educated, it's going to lead to a disaster and all the young people will stop being religious because who wants to live like that, then obviously you have to teach. And once you're teaching secular subjects, you have to be the best and the brightest. But if you're still living in a society where it's a backward society, secularly, and it's a ghetto and all you do is study Torah all day, what's wrong with that? The Vilna Gaon, you know, there's nothing wrong with living like that. So Hildesheimer really saw no inherent value in secular studies, as Hirsch did. Practically, it really means the same thing. Because in the modern world, you have to become secularly educated, rabbi doctors, you know, devote yourself. But in theory, there really is a great difference. And Hildesheimer had no desire to proselytize his views. If there are people living in other countries, he didn't feel that they were lacking at all. Whereas Hirsch really felt that if you're living in the ghetto, you're missing what Torah wants you to be. Torah wants you to be out there, conquering. The mission is to bring Torah Hashem Tamima to everything, to show that Torah functions in all civilizations. That Hirsch, that's a romantic view. That's Hirsch's romanticism coming to the fore. Hildesheimer was not a romantic. He wasn't a philosopher. He was an academic. He was a practical person. In today's day and age, we can't be ignorant. Okay, we see the time. I still have between five and ten minutes about Hildesheimer, and I want to discuss some views of his about conversion, because they're going to come into conflict with his own student, W.T. Hoffman, and they're very relevant to what's in the news. But we don't have time to get into that today, and also the view of Austerlitz. Hildesheimer had a slightly different view of how to relate to the non-religious than Hirsch. So I see we need about 10 more minutes. We will pick up on that next class, do 10 minutes of Hildesheimer, and then move into the great Melamed Hohel, Rav W.T. Hoffman. So if now we have questions, we'll go for as long as we need. Okay, the question is about being Mesader Kiddushin inside a synagogue. That was not one of the decrees, but that was off limits also. The question is, Hungary, can you have a wedding in a synagogue? In theory, what's the problem with it? The problem is that the reformers started doing that. Traditionally, Jews didn't have it in synagogues. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I mean, you could have a wedding anywhere you want. But then the reformers started doing it, just like the church started doing it. And, you know, if you know the church, Catholic Church, you have to get married in a church. And the reformers said that we have to get married in synagogues. Therefore, the rabbis in Hungary declared that you could not get married anywhere else. It wasn't one of the decrees at Michalowicz. I'm 99% sure. I'm going to check on this. It wasn't one of the decrees at Michalowicz. It was a later idea, they said, but I'll check on that for next week. And they never did. So much so that to this day you'll find certain Hungarian rabbis and others who will not even go to a wedding in a shul. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked about this, and his answer was that in Hungary it was an emergency measure, and therefore they said you can't do it, but in America it's not an issue. In Lithuania, it's not an issue. People are doing it in shul because it's a nice place, it's beautiful, they're not doing it to imitate the reformers. So I will check on that. I don't know. Are there any people today that you know that won't do a marriage in a shul, any rabbanim? I know Rav David Lifshitz never liked to do it, but he did it. Rabbi Kalman Shaken said, you know rabbis who will not do a marriage in a shul? Your wedding, okay, and Chabad won't do it in shul, maybe? I find it hard to believe Chabad does. But if you tell me, I believe it. But certainly the Litvisha world, you know, the Rav himself didn't like it. He preferred not to. But he did. He was in Sada Kedushin plenty of times in weddings also. Because if you don't need to, why do it? But it's in America, the halls are attached to shuls. You have nice seating. It's become, it's really not a problem. I can't imagine. It's the same thing like with having, this is one of the decrees also, I believe, the Bima. The reformers moved the Bima. Even in Germany, they said this is a problem. They moved the Bima close. Instead of being in the middle, close to the Ark. What's the problem with that? If you look in the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, he says that that's where you can have it. It's a nice place to have it. But once the reformers started doing it, then the Orthodox said you can't, and that they even declared you can't go to shuls that have the bima in the wrong place. But in America, if a shul is built like that, you know, what's the big deal? I think Rav Moshe also speaks about that as well. It's not a problem because it wasn't done dafka to imitate the reformers, but you don't do it. And I was in a shul not too long ago where they recently had moved the bima. I think maybe in the 20s or 30s it was moved close to the Ark, and now they moved it back. Where a bima really should be. It should be in the middle. Okay, other questions. The English sermon. I'm not sure I understand. You're mentioning what Rabbi Kalman's saying. You're talking about various reforms. The sermon in English, kosher. I mean, obviously.
He asked, are there any practices that the Orthodox have adopted from the Reform? So I'm saying
sure.
Half of what we do in our shuls is adopted from the Reform. The fact that we speak in English, the congregational singing, brotherhood, sisterhood, there's a lot of stuff we've adopted from the Reform.
And also from the Reconstruction, Mordechai Kaplan. But I think we need to distinguish, because even if there wasn't a Reform, we would have had been speaking in English. And I think even if there wasn't a Reform, we still would be preaching. The preachers, the once-a-week preachers, didn't come from the Reform. They came from the Protestant preachers. I will speak next class a bit about Meir Mordechai Horovitz, who discusses this. Well, how is it possible, Mutter, that we can wear gowns, these robes? After all, we took this from the Christians. And he explains what the whole idea of Chukos HaGoyim is and Chukos HaBikarsim. Congregational singing, this wasn't done. It wasn't even really done in Germany. It was more of a choir singing. This is really an American thing, congregational singing. It might even be the development of the Young Israel movement to try to get people involved. In Germany, Professor Breuer told me that they didn't have congregational singing. They had choir singing. So fine, you can hum along. But, you know, if you ever go to a show with a choir, you don't want to sing too loud. They'll shush you because they want to hear the choir. So this is really a very American thing, congregational singing, getting involved. And if anyone likes it, as I do, when you go to sometimes the Yeshiva Shemin, and even for Kel Adon, Chas V'Shalom, that they sing that, It becomes very annoying because it becomes for them a matter of principle that you can't even sing Kael Adon or anything like that. But what can you do? They are the traditional ones. You didn't sing Kael Adon in the past, or Lecha Dodi even. They won't even sing Lecha Dodi. The Chazan sings and you're supposed to mumble it. But what can you do? That is traditionalism. All I would say is that, as you know, tradition isn't always the best. You know, what can I tell you? Yeah, so today, traditional singing is about, it's really Hasidus too. The Hasidim didn't sing with words, but they had nigunim and everything. It's a way of bringing people, you know, getting them together, spirited and everything. So if anyone is going to say, that's Chadash Osir Min HaTorah, I mean, come on. Okay, what did you say, Rabbi?
The Rav and, you know, the Masor. You know, the Rav did not allow any congregation to sing his minyan in Maimonides. And he had a whole halakhic approach that it's a davar shevikdusha, and a davar shevikdusha has to be said responsibly. I mean, almost nobody follows that. But the Rav in Maimonides did not allow any congregational singing, and the Chazan had to repeat every single word out loud, and only the Chazan for all of our Shani Yom Kippur, etc.
But, you know, the Briskers, they can be sometimes somewhat dowered. You know, they never sang Zmiros on Shabbos. And Nevesharava mentions that his son, his grandchildren, would make fun of him like he didn't sing Zmiros. The Brisker Rav claimed, whereas Rav Nachman said, Mitzvah Gedol Alios B'Simcha, it really should be Simcha Gedol Alios B'Mitzvah. And the whole idea of singing, they're very intellectual. I wouldn't say Spock-oriented, but they're very much in the head. And that's fine, but I think for everyone else, the classic story is in Lachak Man, where the Rav as a kid is saying Tehillim with the Hamonam, and his father says, you know, why don't you learn Hilchos Shofar or something. What can I say? Singing is, I would think that almost all American Jews in this respect are much more Hasidic than Misnagdic. We all love a good song, and look at the Karlbach Minyan. I can't explain it, but the Karlbach Minyanim are really taking off, It's neo-Hasidism that everyone seems to be drawn to today. Okay, a few more questions. It's your observation, Svi, that this school of thought has had very little impact on contemporary Judaism. It happens, I think, to have an enormous impact. Yeshiva University, ideologically, comes out of this. If you look at Revel's early lectures, look in Rakevitz's book, he has all of Revel's speeches at the president at graduations. Everyone mentions German Orthodoxy. German Orthodoxy really created the movement that brought into being not just Yeshiva University, Bar Ilan, you're thinking about Michala, the entire religious school system in Israel. Mamachti Dati was established by German Orthodox, so it's had an enormous impact. The Hezder movement, you know, so yes, now you're talking about the ascendancy of Art Scroll and the Haredim. You're right. They're more on the ascendancy today. But the fact that there is a modern Orthodoxy at all, this comes out of thought patterns nourished in Germany. I wouldn't say that modern Orthodoxy has been completely vanquished and destroyed. There still seems to be, a strong contingent of it. So it has a great deal of impact. It could be that it can't have mass appeal of the sort maybe you're thinking of. Art Scroll has a mass appeal. Maybe the masses, the sort of Orthodoxy we're talking about, is not something that can appeal to them. And in Germany, though, the German Orthodoxy wasn't intellectual completely. It also was a cultural Orthodoxy. So the Hamonam, they would relate to it culturally. But you still see it. I mean, your typical modern Orthodox shul is still full of people who, ironically, intellectually are getting their sustenance from Art Scroll, but culturally are still very much part of the old German Orthodox. They believe that their children should go to university, and they believe in secular studies. Yes, when they review the Parsha, they're looking at Art Scroll. But that's because the modern Orthodox have basically ceded all of this to the Haredis. And they've really, in the modern Orthodox, the only thing you get are intellectuals writing essays for other intellectuals. I mentioned this in my Sfarim blog post. But that's the YU was offered, the Schopensteins went to YU to write a Siddur, a Chumash. And they turned it down. So then they went to Art Scroll. So, you know, if the modern Orthodox are not going to do these sorts of things, call a kavod to Art Scroll.
I always thought it very ironic that Hirsch, with his broad view of secular education and of synthesis, left when it came to the application, such as, we'll say, the academic study of Jewish texts, shied away from it. So on the one hand, you have...
Yeah. You meant, Rabbi Hirsch mentioned that last week. And if you read what Hirsch's son says in his letter, the reason is, like I was mentioning before, that this destroys the Kedusha. When you're stuck on a difficult verse and you start looking at Arabic cognates, or when you're stuck on a difficult sugya and you start explaining that maybe the Amoraim were missing certain Toseftas, it takes away the traditional feel. Now, as I said at the very beginning, there are reasons why modern people today are, for some reason, drawn to the academic approach. We have a more intellectual sophistication, perhaps, that it's either brisk or academics, not the old-fashioned way. But Hirsch sensed it almost intuitively, and he created, as it were, a fence. Academic excellence, but when it comes to Torah, traditional type learning. But it's not so unusual today. If you look at many modern Orthodox institutions, I think if you speak to the Rosh Yeshiva, for example, at YU, you saw Rav Schechter in his interview and others, they believe in secular studies, in getting a physics degree and a math degree. They don't believe in academic Jewish studies. They think it's dangerous, and to an extent, they're right. First of all, it is dangerous. It leads away from traditional Torah study. Had Professor Feldblum never gone to Avram Weiss to study academic Talmud, he could have been on a great Rosh Yeshiva. And they think it destroys proper Torah study. So the Berlin people agreed with you, Stanley, that it's inconsistent. You accept the modern world, but you don't accept modern scholarship. And on the other hand, Hirsch thought that you have to distinguish. You know, Torah is sui generis. You know, it has to be approached traditionally. A traditional work can only be understood traditionally. That's what Hirsch said. In any event, this was very helpful. Thank you all for the questions. As I said, we'll pick up next week about 10 minutes more of Hildesheimer. Very interesting stuff, especially about conversion, which is relevant. And then we'll move on to the greatest German postdoc of the 20th century, one of the greatest post-scheme of modern times, and the most influential, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the Melamed Lahoil. So, Mir Hashem, we'll see you next week. For those who are in America, have a happy Thanksgiving, and the rest of you, we will see you later. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Have a good night. Okay, good night, everybody.